Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, Dennis Miller, late-night comedy show hosts on the left and the right are getting increasingly open about their politics as more and more Americans, those in the coveted 18 to 49 demographic in particular, are turning to their shows for the news. Late-night TV shows have become a routine stop on the campaign trails of aspiring politicians. Now, a lot of late-night comedy is becoming all politics all the time, and politics with a partisan razor edge. Tonight on Point, the politics of humor and the humor of politics. But first, major European nations are today rejecting a truce offered on audio tape by a man claiming to be Osama bin Laden. Arab television aired the tape offering a truce to countries that don't kill Muslims. Bob Drogan covers national security for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him how sure the intelligence community is that the tape is indeed from bin Laden.
The CIA says it's most likely is bin Laden. They do what they call a technical analysis where they check the tape against known samples of his voice and come up with a conclusion. And generally it takes about 24 hours, and that's what the way this one went down.
So they think it is bin Laden. And exactly what is he saying here?
Well, this is the first time we've heard from him, or apparently heard from him, since January of 2003. This tape is different than some of the others. He is essentially offering what sounds like a truce to what he refers to our neighbors north of the Mediterranean, meaning obviously Europe, saying that for the next 3 months he is offering a truce to any country that pulls its troops out of what it refers to as its Muslim lands. The implication is presumably Iraq.
So Europeans go home, and we will what or won't do what?
Well, we will continue fighting the United States. We will continue fighting Europe. The language, that, at least the way it's translated, he refers to, he says their war will continue against what he refers to as President Bush and other leaders, big media institutions, and the United Nations. He refers to all of them as a fatal danger, and he vows revenge to them all.
And he specifically mentions the train bombing in Spain and says that this was an example of al-Qaeda's reach and its revenge or justice.
Well, he refers more specifically to the events of March 11th, which are the bombs that in Madrid that killed nearly 200 people. He refers a little more specifically to Israel's targeted killing of Ahmed Yassin, the head of Hamas, several weeks ago. So it's all recent is the point. This is all within the last several weeks.
The truce offer is not extended to the United States or Israel. What does he say about those two countries?
He vows overall, he tries to make the argument, and I don't think we've seen this in the same way, that this is not a war of terrorism. They are not spilling innocent blood, but rather they are retaliating always against countries that are involved in support of the United States and Israel against Muslim nations. Now, on the face of that, it's sort of ludicrous if you think of the attacks of, against tourists in Bali or commuters in Spain or something. But he makes this argument that this is essentially they are fighting a war of defense on their side, which is a bit odd.
Bob Drogan, there have been a number of bin Laden tapes now since early after 9/11. You and I have talked about a number of them. Do you see an arc or a path to the evolution of the message here at all?
Well, this is the ninth tape since September 11. This one is an audio tape. We don't have a recent picture of bin Laden. We haven't seen any video of him since last fall. I think it was September, and we're not really sure when those pictures were taken. It obviously means, if this is indeed bin Laden, that he's alive or was alive as of several weeks ago. There's still always been speculation as to where he is. The CIA says they still think he's up somewhere on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. You know, this is viewed as an attempt, at least here in Washington, as an attempt to drive a wedge between the United States and its allies in Europe. It's sort of big politics that we don't generally get from bin Laden, whose tapes tend to be more on the order of bolstering morale and exhorting the troops, if you will, more in the sort of mystical appeals to Islamic solidarity. This is almost as if he's, you know, making an appeal to the European public, people who are against the war, and to their leadership. You know, this is your chance to get out of the crosshairs here, pull out of away from the United States, and we'll leave you alone. I should add that the leaders in London and of Germany and Italy and Spain and the European Commission, the French, have all very quickly rejected this and all denounced this, said there's no way they're going to try and make some kind of deal with a terrorist.
Nevertheless, here's bin Laden not only alive but very much engaged, trying to play an active role in geopolitics through his messages.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating on that level that this is him trying to reach out to leadership of European nations and to the European public in a way we really haven't seen before.
And, of course, also to the Arab public. This was first aired on Arab TV again, so the messages are coming really first right to his home turf.
That's right, and it's in Arabic, of course, and it's a 7-minute tape. I mean, it's a long description, and it just tries to justify what their attacks are about. It says that they didn't attack Russians, for example, until Russia had, you know, invaded Afghanistan, and it didn't attack European nations until they began supporting the United States in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, it makes a series of arguments mm-hmm. that are sort of spurious on their face, but this is the argument that they're making. And I think it's a different one, because it's no longer simply saying we are who we are because we're against the infidel, but rather we are a war to protect our people because they are attacking us. It also, by speaking out for so strongly against the attack of the Hamas leader by Israel, it again attempts to do something that we really only began to see after September 11, which is al-Qaeda trying to align itself with the Palestinians, which was not, for the first 10 years or so, was not really part of their rhetoric.
Must drive American authorities crazy to have him being such an active participant in the global political dialogue all these years after President Bush said we will get him dead or alive.
Well, I think the White House views this, you know, they don't necessarily regret having a reminder out in the public that their target, if you will, enemy number one, is still alive and well. Obviously, this is not what they would prefer, but politically, it reminds people that there is a war on terrorism, and I think from the White House point of view, that's a positive thing.
Bob Drogon, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogon covers national security for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. John Stewart fans are used to a daily dose of fun and games with George Bush. Dennis Miller watchers are intimately familiar with John Kerry's mockable side. Is it news? Is it funny? Is it both? Do you get your news now from late-night satire shows, your laughs? And why has so much political conversation migrated to comedy shows? And is their brand of political humor a hoot, or is it too agenda-driven to whack your funny bone? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's touch the baseline of late-night humor. Here's Jay Leno on politics just last night.
President Bush released his tax returns yesterday. He listed the economy as a liability. If he gets to write that off. No, President Bush listed his income as $822,000. You know what John Kerry calls someone who earned $822,000? Not even worth dating.
Not worth dating. There's Jay Leno in politics, the fodder. Joining me now from New York is Lee Siegel, TV critic for The New Republic and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Lee Siegel, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, my pleasure.
It's great to have you. Lee Siegel, you've put together a very interesting and funny itself kind of critique of what's going on with late-night humor and political humor in particular, and you're not focused, I should say, first and foremost, on Jay Leno. You're really looking at the new breed, at the Bill Maher's, at the Dennis Miller's, on radio at Al Franken, and maybe even now Jon Stewart. What's your complaint with this wildly popular new form of late-night political humor, Lee?
Well, I don't think it's humorous. I think it's too political to be humorous. You know, these guys all have a positive agenda, a partisan agenda. They want to say something clarifying, educative, edifying. I don't think there's anything funny about that.
But you hear the people laughing. It's not all laugh track.
Well, I don't know why they're laughing. I don't know what's been dispensed to them. I don't know what nefarious machinations are going on.
Alcoholic supplements, yeah.
On stage. I don't even want to go there. But, you know, Lenny Bruce said, He said, the truth is what is, not what should be. What should be is a dirty lie. I bet he didn't use the word dirty. But I think that's true. I don't think ought or should is for comedy. I think comedy is. I think ought or should is for politics.
And your complaint here is you see a kind of new earnestness in political agendas you see being pushed by these late-night comics satirists.
Yeah, that's right. A few weeks ago, Jon Stewart had Al Franken on, and these two guys, renowned for their humor, famous for being so-called political satirists, just spoke very seriously about the State of the Union. That's very disheartening.
Because you think that's just off-limits to comics? Is that your point? I mean, they shouldn't be able to talk about politics, or if they're going to call themselves comics, just be comical? What should they be doing?
They can use that
forbidden word.
They could do whatever they want, but if they want to be funny, I think they should be funny rather than weighing in very gravely on the issues. They can do that, but then they're not funny. They're comics, but they're unfunny comics.
Let's listen to just a little bit of Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Here he takes on one of his favorite targets, President George W. Bush.
Our President Bush tried to explain away the chaos caused by solder.
This is one person who's deciding that rather than allow democracy to flourish, she's going to exercise force. We just can't let it stand.
Yes. One person's decision to exercise force would be a terrible way to create a democracy. I see nothing. I hear nothing. But perhaps, maybe the president is smiling because he knows we're turning over control of Iraq on June 30th. And the president has a very specific plan for how that's going to go down.
The United States representative is there now to work on the onto whom we transfer sovereignty. I mean, in other words, it's one thing to decide to transfer. We're now in the process of deciding what the entity will look like to whom we will transfer sovereignty. But the date remains firm.
So there you have it, folks. Everything is in place for the June 30th handoff of power, except who the recipient of the handoff is.
That little matter. There's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, Comedy Central's cable, late night, increasingly political satire show. Lee Siegel, I've got to say, I enjoy tuning in on these things. They seem to be tremendously popular. The networks or cable channels are putting them all over the place. How do you draw the arc of what's going on here? The people are turning to these. You can find plenty of people who say, this is where I get my news.
Well, people turn to a lot of things. They're rushing to see Mel Gibson's movie about Christ. And I don't know if popularity is any sign of quality. People are free to enjoy it. You know, when I wrote this, a lot of people got very angry and indignant as if I'd right. been caught stealing food off Stephen Hawking's plate or something like that. But I didn't say that Jon Stewart wasn't funny. I just said I thought he wasn't funny. There's a difference. I think the reason he is popular is because people do feel helpless in the face of what is obviously a great lie in Washington. They feel helpless before the absurdity of George W. Bush, and they want more. More active exposure of who these guys really are. It's exasperating and maddening to watch the neutral, more or less, evening news, mm-hmm. and listen to these guys talk and you know, want to kick your TV and not have anybody call them to account. And I think Stewart and Marr and Miller, I think they serve that purpose. They're cathartic.
But Lee Siegel, you say that by aligning themselves with an ideology, with a politics, Franken, Mahler, Miller, weigh their comic negativity down with a positive premise. They actually believe in the power of the ballot box to shape the country's future. That may be politics, you say, but that's not funny.
Yes, if I'm looking for serious politics, I'm going to go to serious political commentary, and I don't want that to be funny. But if I'm looking for humor, I don't want some kind of forward-looking, optimistic agenda squarely in the American tradition of sunniness and cheerfulness. I want raw, devastating, free-for-all, no-holds-barred comedy. That's what I want.
It sounds
like I don't want somebody showing clips of Bush speaking and listening to an audience laugh without even any kind of attempt at creating humor. Everyone's just primed to laugh at this guy because he is patently absurd, but that's different from creative humor.
We're going to hear more and see what we're laughing at tonight. Lee Siegel says it's more like throwing fruit than making jokes. I'm joined tonight by Lee Siegel, TV critic for The New Republic, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. We're talking about this election year's late-night fun fest of political humor and what it says about American politics and American humor. You can join us, Do You Get Your News, from the late-night satire shows. Do You Get Your Laughs from the late-night satire shows. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about this election year's late-night fun fest of political humor, political satire, from Bill Maher to Dennis Miller to Jon Stewart and more. You can join our conversation tonight. Why has so much American political conversation migrated to comedy shows? Is this political humor funny? Is it too agenda-driven to whack your funny bone? Are Maher on the left and Miller on the right there to make you guffaw or to make you cheer for your team? And is the new style too earnest to be high comedy, or does it have you rolling right off your couch? Let's listen to just a little bit of Dennis Miller going after John Kerry.
A new poll indicates that voters don't feel that John Kerry has clearly defined himself. When asked about the poll, an exasperated Kerry said flatly, "You want me to define myself? Crazy ambition, rich old lady." And AFL-CIO officials are urging the Democratic presidential candidate to, quote, warm up and try to form an emotional bond with undecided union workers. In response, Kerry memorized the lyrics to "Take This Job and Shove It" and practiced drinking domestic beer without gagging. Senator Kerry wrote a column about Iraq that appeared in Tuesday's Washington Post. The column was so full of inconsistencies, Kerry was then offered a job at the New York Times.
Dennis Miller, just last night, going after politics as usual. We're joined tonight by Lee Siegel, TV critic for The New Republic magazine, and from New York by Dan Gore, a writer for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Dan was also a writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart from 1998 to 2001. Good evening and welcome, Dan Gore.
Good evening. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. Dan, we're trying to get our hands around exactly what's going on with all this late-night talk and laughter, humor, satire, and political agenda driving. When you were writing for, we'll talk about Conan in a moment, but when you wrote for The Daily Show, what were your marching orders? Is Jon Stewart now, you know, fully on board with an agenda, going after one side or the other? How did you see it?
I definitely think Jon Stewart is not marching with an agenda. John was always very careful to hit targets on both sides. I think that was often very frustrating for the writers. Although, you know, I think he did a great job and continues to do a great job of going after people from both the right and the left. I mean, I think the fact is that the party that's in office presents the largest target.
The big, so, fat, juicy, sitting target.
Yeah, and this is a juicier target than most, perhaps. So, I mean, my first day at The Daily Show was August 17th, 1998. That was, I believe, the day that Bill Clinton apologized or admitted that Monica Lewinsky and he had had sexual relations.
Yeah.
I must have written, and this is no exaggeration, 700 or so Clinton jokes. When Clinton was in office, he was the target. And I think that, so, I mean, if you judge the clip that was just played, was Jon Stewart responding to, you know, a series of Bush comments. I think that if you were to play a clip from 1999 or 2000, you'd hear him going after Clinton. And I'm sure after Kerry's performance in a debate, you'd hear him going after Kerry.
But Dan,
Lee Siegel, yeah,
please jump in.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, Stewart had Richard Clark on. And he had spent days before that touting Clark's book in a very serious way. It was mind-blowing, he said. It was insane. It gave a window onto the inner workings of government. You know, I stayed up 11 o'clock till 11 o'clock to laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still not laughing. Then he has Richard Clark on. I gave it a shot another night. By now I'm exhausted because I try to go to bed early. And he has Clark on, and they just talked. It's not a question of going after this side or that side. Stewart really, he wants to, quote, make a difference. You know, he wants to do something that
that's
in a different
from,
in a different era. No, I think that's what he does. Would be itself mockable. So all I'm saying is that because of his partisan sympathies, he's not funny. I'm not saying that he doesn't, on occasion, attack both sides.
Lee and Dan, let's listen to just a little bit of that interview, John Stewart talking to former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark.
I was saying to somebody as I watched your testimony, I felt like the first time I saw a watch in clear lucite, and I go, oh, that's how it works? The gears just turn around like that? It was fascinating to see someone plainly speaking about the way it functions.
Well, John, government is just people. You know, it's just people like you and me.
Oh, God, don't say that.
And unless good people go into government, at least for a few years, but better for a career, then you get, you know, bad decisions, bad results. Unfortunately, an awful lot of people who have been in government for a long time, professionals trying to defend this country, are quitting right and left because they can't stand these kinds of tactics that the administration is using.
Well, certainly after seeing what's happened to you, I'm sure they'll be encouraged.
And there you are, John Stewart of The Daily Show, talking with former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. And here we have it, Dan Gore. I guess this is a sort of a kind of exhibit A of what bugs Lee Siegel.
Sure.
Yes, there's laughter and there are jibes, but there's also this in the middle of it, this earnest conversation about, of all things, good government. Lee is saying, you know, in the good old days, they just went straight at whoever was in power and none of this soft soap on the side.
Well, who went after whoever was in charge with none of the soft soap? I mean, I don't think late night television did so much. Or those shows that did continue to. I mean, I think SNL continues to do the same type of parody that they did all along. I mean, I don't think John is trying to deceive the viewers. I think that there are portions of the show which are out-and-out comedy with jokes, and then there are portions of the show which are more informative. And I think that viewers turn to him for a combination of the two. And so if you were looking for only one, you might be dispirited by it. But I don't think that that's the type of show it's become, I think, or is, I think. And so I don't think that it's necessarily fair to say I turned to it and expected to laugh from start to finish. I don't think he advertises himself as such. I think when he is being funny, he is extremely funny, and people are laughing uproariously. But you know, it's a balance. There's also the informative, or maybe earnest, or maybe if it's not to your taste, overly earnest aspect of the show.
Well, then it should be called comedy decentralized.
Oh, well,
that's not fairly Republican.
I don't think that the comedy in Comedy Central necessarily implies that everything on Comedy Central is funny.
I want to let our callers in here. We're talking tonight about what's going on with comedy and politics late at night. Is it hitting your funny bone? Is it illuminating your world? Is it doing something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Venkat is calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Venkat. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Hi. Great. Thanks.
I'm just calling to disagree with your first caller who is dismissive of these stand-up comedians and say that they actually play a pretty useful role. And I sometimes find that it's worthwhile to stay up until 11 o'clock in the night to watch Dennis Miller. And you know, at the very least, the guy is taking pot shots on both ends of the political spectrum. And I sometimes feel that, you know, Dennis Miller probably gives me a fair and balanced approach.
Fair and balanced as in Fox News fair and balanced. I mean, he's become awfully conservative, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, not to say others aren't liberal, but there he is. Venkat, don't you see him that way?
I'm sorry? I didn't get it.
Don't you say fair and balanced, and fair enough, maybe that's the way you see it, but Dennis Miller has become famously conservative recently, as others
it's
have
like
become famously liberal.
Well, I think Dennis Miller swings both ways. And you know, he sometimes even you know, broaches upon topics that border on the philosophical. I remember a few days ago, Dennis Miller made a remark. I forget the exact words, but it was something to the effect that, let me try and recollect what he said. He said, you know, as much as our lives have improved in the last last century, it pays to keep in mind that human nature hasn't evolved a whole lot. And it pays to keep in perspective that it's taken a human being 4 million years to grow a thumb, and it might take him an equal number of years to you know, pull his thumb out of a certain body part that the FCC wouldn't like my mentor.
So pearls of wisdom from our new conservative comic, Late at Night, Venkat. Thanks for your call. Dan Gore, I heard you there.
Yeah, I think calling him somebody who's representative of both sides of the political spectrum is like saying that somebody is moderate because they lie in between Franco and Mussolini. I mean, this is a guy right. who makes no bones about the fact that he's as conservative as they come. In fact, I think that he does a disservice to his comedy by being so unbelievably partisan. I mean, the clips you played sound like a guy who's just is a bully. He's beating somebody up. He's putting words in the guy's mouth and just beating him up. I mean, he sounds like DeLay going after Kerry for looking French.
Yeah, well, let's talk about degrees of partisanship. Lee Siegel, do you agree? Does Dennis Miller define it, or you know, sort of the outlier here, or is Bill Maher as partisan in the opposite direction?
Well, again, we're talking about comedians, men who spent their life performing and trying to please audiences and trying to make people laugh, as though their politics really mattered.
Well, they do matter now, don't they? I mean, they're obvious. They're on their sleeves. They're part of their show.
I don't think they do matter. I think they matter only to the converted who tune into these shows. I don't think they affect public perception of politics in this country. I don't think Miller makes Democrats Republican or Maher makes conservatives liberal. I don't think their politics matters one bit.
But aren't these guys whipping up images and lines and observations that then work their way into the political debate, the political conversation, certainly political impressions? Aren't they creating images and understandings of political leaders, Dan?
Well, I think it's sad if they are, to some extent. I mean, first let me just respond by saying I think Bill Maher actually does package himself as somebody who, I mean, sorry, Dennis Miller, at least, as somebody who is taking a political position. I mean, that was a political talk show with no audience for the first few weeks until that turned out to be a failure. And then they had to bring an audience in. I mean, I think this is a guy who has an agenda. Whether or not that matters is a different question. And whether or not he converts people, I don't think so.
But I don't want to pin this just on Dennis. I mean, listen to Bill Maher, even listen to Jon Stewart. Lee Siegel says he's becoming more and more partisan. I'd have to say I think I hear that. But do you hear the same thing, Dan? Let's say in Bill Maher first. I mean, you've got to see him as a liberal comic.
Yeah,
Lee,
no,
Lee
sure,
hates that,
sure
that
he
twinning
is.
Still.
I haven't.
Tom, an intellectual hatred is the worst. Someone once said. I don't hate anyone. We have to get that straight.
No, I just mean the twinning of politics and comedy. I'm hearing.
I'm only kidding.
You're
actually,
no big fan.
I hate a lot of people. I'm joking.
Let's get another call. Willie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Willie. You're on the air.
Hi. I think we learned from our weekly that started in Madison, The Onion. There was so often when the headlines and lead stories on the humor paper, The Onion, were so much closer to the truth. A good example was probably immediately after the Bush inauguration, much closer to the truth. And, you know, you can determine some of the truth by going online and finding a lot of different sources.
Willie, closer
but
to the truth than
our
what?
Media, our media is so corrupt, so afraid to be controversial, or so obviously dishonest and partisan. I mean, it does justice to our politicians. That's much better. You really, I think, get better information from the stuff that isn't, you know, first and foremost supposedly giving you any information.
Willie, we've got it. Your line's a little rough, but let us take that. Lee Siegel, how about it? I mean, comedy has always, or many comedians have had some aspiration to using it to get at truth, even when it was hard and brutal. If people feel that scabs are being pulled off, that veils are being pulled down by these comics, what's the harm? Isn't there value in that?
I'm not speaking in terms of truthfulness or harm. I'm just saying that they're not funny. You know, these guys have an idea of good government. Well, I guess I do. I guess all rational people, voting citizens do. But I think under the aspect of comedy, there's no such thing as good government. It's all floating and in a churning turmoil of excrement. It's all chaos and anarchy. In terms of truth, what's true? Lenny Bruce said that the great thing about masturbation was that you didn't have to send your hand home in a cab. Where's the truth? What's being exposed? The truthfulness?
That's certainly true.
Well, it sounds like a truth to me.
Well, Tom, again, I, you know, I, Well, maybe it's good that you're staying up late and watching late night TV and keeping yourself out of trouble.
let's get a little historical perspective here, just to see how it lands into this conversation. Turn the wheels of time back to 1968, and here is the Laugh-In giving out a new award, the Flying Fickle Finger of Fate.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've all been so nice to us, we'd like to be nice to some of you.
So we came up with the Laugh-In Award for Outstanding Achievement, and here it is.
This is the Flying Fickle Finger of Fate Award, which will be given each week to that person or group who have proven they truly deserve to receive the Flying Fickle Finger of Fate Award.
And our first winner is...
May I have the envelope, please? Go get the envelope, Goldie. Thank you. And the winner is the United States Congress, established 1781 as a lobby for the American people, for ignoring the wishes of 200 million Americans and delaying passage of a gun control law, we hereby present Congress with a first Flying Fickle Finger of Fate. You ought to be more careful with that thing.
I didn't know it was loaded.
There it is from 1968, and let's get a little more historical perspective while we're at it, looking back in that same year to the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Here, Dick Smothers talks with his brother, Tom, about not spoofing the new president, Richard Nixon.
You got to watch yourself, Tommy. No more Nixon jokes, okay?
No, whatever anyone else says, that's what might say Richard Nixon is our president-elect, and he's got the toughest job.
Now, you're not
putting me on.
I mean, you're serious, right?
Well, we've all played, I think everybody we can say has played a little loose with his image during the campaign. But that's all behind us now, because he's our man.
That's right. And history has shown us that almost every president begins his term in office with the support, the absolute support of the entire nation, and free from slanders and jokes.
That's right, Dickie. And for the start of his term, we are going to give our President Nixon our full support and lay off the jokes entirely.
That's right.
He's going to be in office for at least 4 years, and I'm sure we'll be able to get around to him a little bit
later. Now, wait a minute.
The Smothers Brothers saying it will be free from slanders and jokes. Lee Siegel, are you making a case that this kind of TV humor has changed since 1968, since what we're hearing there? In what direction, if it has?
Well, just as a historical footnote, I think Nixon appeared on Laugh-In. Wasn't he one of the first?
Yes, he did.
I forget his line, but
he came on and said something very silly. And
as another historical footnote, at the risk of bolstering Lee's argument, I don't think either of those bits got all that much laughter. I mean, I think there was a lot of applause after both of them. I mean, so you may have a point.
I think in the examples that you just played, I think the Smothers Brother, you could not discriminate. You could not tell what their politics were. Certainly, they were not driving home some partisan point about the liberal nature of the New York Times or the venal nature of the Republicans on the 9/11 panel who were interrogating Clark. So I think it was dry and ironic, and it was rather funny. In the first instance, Laugh-In, I don't remember it that well, but they were obviously expressing some kind of outrage against the gun control laws. That's not that funny.
Well, Lee Siegel, Dan Gore, stand by. Listeners, you can join us tonight. We're looking at the Late Night Fun Fest of Political Humor. Is it funny for you? Is it high humor? Is it politics and agenda-driven? Is it working? Are you addicted to the late-night jabs and chuckles or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about this election year's late night fun fest of political humor and what it says about American politics and American humor. You can join our conversation. Are you addicted to those late night jabs and chuckles? How do the new political comics stack up against Lenny Bruce, Jack Parr, Dick Gregory, Mort Sahl? What makes you laugh these days. Of course, we've got with us tonight Dan Gore from New York. He writes for Conan O'Brien and was formerly a writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart from 98 to 2001. Also with us tonight from New York, Lee Siegel, TV critic for The New Republic. He is not crazy about the new breed of political humor. Let's hear just a little bit of Conan O'Brien. This is Conan interviewing President Bush during his state visit with Prime Minister Tony Blair in London last November.
You're ahead of us. It's 5:30 in the morning over there.
That's right, Conan. I'm talking to you from the future.
No, no, sir. That's just the standard time difference.
No, no, that ain't no standard time difference, Conan. It's the future.
Obviously, not really President Bush. Listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Rob is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. A terrific show.
Thanks.
The Nixon line, I believe, on Laugh-In was "Sock it to me."
Of course. How could I forget? Of course. "Sock it to me." Tricky
and,
Dick.
Much of what I had, you've made allusions to already, listing Saul, the Smothers Brothers that you played. There is a history of political humor, political satire,
of course,
including
sure.
others like Carlin and Tom Lehrer, and That Was the Week That Was, mm-hmm. going even back to the writing radio Will Rogers and,
yep.
and Mark Twain. I'm reminded as I'm listening to Lee Siegel speak of a routine that Al Brooks did on an early Saturday Night Live explaining a focus group example of why his routine was funny, trying to convince the people that thought it wasn't
Believe
funny.
Believe me, it's funny. Come on, man.
So I'm curious as to what the definition is, if there's a line. And I'll take my answer off the air, but I've got two other quick things I want to see if you can observe on. Move earlier in prime time to someone like Keith Olbermann, who's now being promoted for his sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
Although when he has John Dean on, he practically endorses going out and buying the book in a non-sarcastic fashion.
Yep, yep.
People like Chris Hitchens, who's pretty acerbic in his wit, and somebody like Molly Ivins, who's pretty warm and still on the progressive side of things.
Let us pick it all up, Rob. Thanks very much for your call. Lee Siegel, what about the big point that Rob's raising here, that we've always had political humorists, but are you drawing a distinction between, you know, going all the way back to Mark Twain and Will Rogers and right on through Tom Lehrer and the rest that he's raising? Are you saying this new breed is somehow different, lesser?
Well, I just think there's a difference between political humor and politicized humor. And I don't think, again, because the latter is so goal-oriented, it's not very funny, that's all.
That the old political humorist would take everybody on as a target, and once you get an agenda driving for you, there's the earnestness, there's the seriousness, there's the loss of the real laugh.
Yeah, that's right. You know where it's going, you know where it's heading, the audience knows where it's going. That's why they laugh even before the punchline is delivered, and it's just it's not entertaining. It doesn't ventilate all my risible faculties, you know.
and the print humorists that Rob is talking about, Christopher Hitchens, Molly Ivins, I mean, it's another thing in print. Do you see them in the same universe as these kind of agenda-driven late-night satirists?
Well, I don't think Christopher would think of himself as a humorist. I think he's a very caustic and biting political commentator who's often very witty, but that's different from being a humorist.
Dan Gore, we heard just a little bit there from Conan. How does Conan O'Brien decide when to go political, or you writers, when you're sitting around? Is it purely opportunistic? Give us a sense about figures in, how it comes in.
I think Conan is very different from these shows that we've been talking about, mm-hmm. insofar as it's really a totally separate sort of sensibility. It's a much sillier show. And when we deal with topical situations or jokes, premises, we do so in a silly manner as opposed to politicizing it.
It's the future.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you have the Bush archetype, and there are a certain type of Bush jokes. But the other day we had two knights dressed up, their knight costumes were made out of campaign buttons.
As in
so we had
armor.
Their knight costumes.
Yep, yep.
Their armor was made out of campaign buttons, and we had them bashing each other with swords. And then the buttons fell off, and then we had a sort of pathetic picture of them picking up the buttons. I'm sure somebody could have read some sort of deeper meaning about the political process into it, but we just thought it looked really dumb.
And when you look over the fence these days, Dan, at the shows that pick up on images from the day or sound bites from the day or political moments from the day and then, you know, play off of those, do you say, well, that we don't do? That's a different thing? Maybe that's the successor to Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update News Desk, and that's a different genre or not?
Yeah, to some extent, we do say that. We would never play down a Bush quote and then do a little joke afterwards. I mean, we would become The Daily Show if we were to do that. I mean, it's a different brand of humor. That being said, we definitely do deal with topical issues, and we do occasionally use the footage. We had Condi Rice testifying, yeah. And then in the split screen where you would expect to see the 9/11 commission, we had Donald Trump fire her, which is, I mean, sort of an obvious joke, right. but it was funny. And I mean, again, the political implication of that was really, really just accidental, because
or irresistible, depending
or irresistible. But I assure you, it was accidental.
Let's go back and listen for just a second to the old original on this playing off the news front. Here's Saturday Night Live Weekend Update. This, a breaking report about President Gerald Ford, delivered by Chevy Chase.
The top story is, of course, the good news that President Ford is over that week-long bout with that stubborn cold. White House physicians say that after a mild cold of that sort, it will take the president a few days to recover his motor skills fully, citing the period after his last cold when he tied his shoe to his hair blower and inadvertently pardoned Richard Nixon.
And off we go. A couple of decades later, we've got Bill Maher, Dennis Miller, and all the rest. Nina's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I teach college students media classes, mm-hmm. and I find it's very difficult to get them to listen to a nightly news program, let alone even read a daily paper. But they will watch The Daily Show, and that often acts as a catalyst for them to at least be aware of current events and hopefully, you know, learn more about current events from other programs and from reading the newspaper.
No, we hear this again and again. Are you serious when you say that is their source of news information? Just this satirized version that they don't read the paper, they don't do the rest?
They will not do that unless, you know, there's a quiz on what was in the newspaper the night before. But they will watch The Daily Show. But like I said, that'll start getting them interested in current events. And then that will open them up to reading more traditional and watching more traditional news programs. So I think it's worthwhile for, you know, they know the news is not geared towards them. If you watch the nightly news, it's geared towards a much older audience. You could just tell by the commercials.
But yeah.
So they will watch The Daily Show because they feel as if it's geared more towards them.
Okay, Nina, thanks very much for your call. Lee Siegel, there it is. It's a way of engagement. You may not call it high comedy, but they're coming to the trough.
Well, things are worse in Cambridge than I thought.
fire in the hole.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
No, go ahead.
No, please. I'm just curious what you make of a generation that is happily getting its news this way, and we've heard the complaint, you know, right here tonight, and you hear it all the time, that people don't feel there's enough candor, enough honesty in the mainstream media. They like this kind of spin, this sort of tearing away of pretense that they hear and see on these shows.
Well, I don't know if it's tearing away pretense. I think it's substituting one pretense for another. It's substituting the pretense of knowing partisanship for the pretense of candor and objectivity. But I do think that the regular news, as I guess we have to call it now, the mainstream, the real news, I think it is more or less objective, the major networks. Obviously, there are problems. There's so many news sources that one could go to now, serious news sources, without having to resort to these politicized humorists.
Well, it's a fascinating point you make, and it's going to be in the back of my mind as I watch with others those shows. Indignation is to comedy, writes Lee Siegel. What turning the lights on is to a party. There's something to chew on. And maybe get a laugh with as well. Lee Siegel, thank you so much for your piece, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
Lee Siegel, TV critic for the New Republic magazine, and Dan Gore, writer for Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and one time with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Thanks so much for being with us. Just great to have you, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the story of one of golf's unheralded heroes. This is On Point. One week ago today, the sport of golf lost one of its unsung heroes with the passing of Bruce Edwards from Lou Gehrig's disease at age 49. Edwards had served as a caddy for one of the game's greats, Tom Watson, for the better part of three decades. The story of their friendship captured the nation's attention last year when Watson took the early lead in the U.S. Open with a slowly dying Edwards carrying his bag. Sportswriter John Feinstein's latest book is Caddy for Life, The Bruce Edwards Story. Here, Feinstein reads a passage from that book. In this scene, Bruce Edwards' wife, Marcia, is calling the Watsons to inform them of Bruce's ALS.
Marcia dialed the Watsons. Tom and Hillary were sitting in Hillary's office in their home when Marcia called. "I've got some news," Marcia said when Hillary answered. Something told Hillary instantly that it wasn't good news, and she handed the phone to Tom, who was sitting on her desk. Tom took the phone, and Hillary sat and watched his face. After he said hello, he listened for a few seconds, and a look came over him that told me that whatever the news was, it was as bad as it could possibly be, she remembered. He didn't say anything for a while, just sat there, tears coming. Then finally he said, "What can we do?" Marcia had come straight to the point when Tom took the phone. There was no way to soften the blow at that moment. "Tom," she said simply, "I'm afraid I have awful news. Bruce has ALS." That was when Watson started to cry. Marcia waited, and when he asked, "What can we do?" her response was immediate. "You need to convince him to stay here for the testing tomorrow. He wants to come home." Watson nodded. "Let me talk to our boy," he said, the words so soft Marcia could barely hear him. She walked the phone back into the room and handed it to Bruce. "Tom wants to talk to you," she said. Again, Bruce tried to lighten the moment. "You heard," he said. "I made quad." Watson almost laughed at Bruce reverting to golf terminology, calling ALS a quadruple bogey. He gave his boy a pep talk. "There's a lot we can still do. We're going to find out all we can about this thing and fight it. But," he added, "you have to stay and finish all the testing." "Tom, I just want to get out of here and go home," Bruce said. Watson became Watson, adamant, firm. "No, Bruce, you're not going to do that," he said. "I understand how you feel, but you have to stay. We start fighting this thing tomorrow, okay?" "Okay," Bruce said, knowing Tom was right. Then he had a thought. "You know, Tom," he said, "it could have been worse." Worse? Watson couldn't imagine how it could possibly have been worse. "Well, I could have had a disease named after Liberace or something," Bruce said. "At least Lou Gehrig was a great athlete. I'd rather tell people I have Gehrig's disease than Liberace's disease." Watson almost laughed. "You never quit, do you?" he said, smiling through his tears. Bruce was crying, too, even as he did the best he could to maintain his sense of humor. He told Watson he would stay and finish the testing and hear what the doctors had to tell him. They were both crying again by the time they hung up the phone. Tom and Hillary had to tell Hillary's children, all of whom knew Bruce well. When they told 13-year-old Paige, Hillary's middle child, she went into her room and after a while came back with several pages of computer printouts. "When you told me about Bruce's symptoms, I went on the computer," she said. "This is what I came up with." She handed them several pages of information on ALS. That was what the computer had told her Bruce had, based on Tom and Hillary's description of his symptoms. Tom read everything Paige handed him that night. The next morning he was up shortly after sunrise at his own computer. He began looking for every piece of information he could find on ALS. History, funding, doctors who were experts, drugs that had been tested, drugs that hadn't been tested. When Hillary asked him what he was doing, his answer was direct. "I'm trying to figure out a way," he said, "to find a cure for ALS." At 53, Tom Watson had a new mission in life. He would tackle it with every bit as much zeal as he had mustered in becoming a star on the PGA Tour. And then some.
Sportswriter and NPR commentator John Feinstein reading from his new book, Caddy for Life, The Bruce Edwards Story. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.